Bible tonight and look at 1 Samuel 25. Again, 1 Samuel 25. And as I mentioned, we read this a couple weeks ago together. And we will read through the heart of the passage again tonight as we study it. So we won't separate out into our reading groups this evening. But I want you to give a quick review of the passage as we get ready to sort of look at it. We started 1 Samuel 25 in our last study, and there are three primary people that are mentioned in the events of 1 Samuel 25. The first person that we're sort of introduced to, of course, it's continuing the narrative of David. David has been being chased by Saul in the previous chapter. David has the opportunity to take Saul's life, but refuses to do it, as he sees it's not the Lord's will for him, that acting out in that violent way would have been wrong to eventually get to what he knew what was right, and that wasn't the Lord's will for him. So then David goes out into the wilderness. We see that at the end of chapter 24 and the beginning of chapter 25. And chapter 25 starts with the death of Samuel. So Samuel, the prophet who faithfully served the Lord even to his older age and ushered in not just the kingdom of David, but also the kingdom of Saul under the Lord's authority and direction. And then we're introduced to this man named Nabal, who we kind of spent the whole of our time last time studying his foolishness. His name literally means foolish or folly. His wife brings that up kind of halfway through the chapter. But we studied the fact, and we have some of them mentioned there to remind you, that this man had, he had good, certain good character traits. He was strong in what he had and what he had owned. He was courageous in the sense that he was not afraid to say or speak something. He had wealth, and he had aspiration and desire. But we see that just having good character qualities but misusing them, or imbalance with what the Lord wants for our life, is foolishness. He had strength, but without love. Courage, but without wisdom. He had wealth without generosity. He had desire, but without self-control. So we looked at him last time, and tonight we're going to look at David's place in the passage as well as Abigail, and to sort of walk our way back through it. David, we know from chapter 25 that he and his men have been out in the wilderness. They've been in a number of places in the southern portion of Israel, all the way back down to where some of the places that just after they crossed and went to Sinai. He's been all in these historical places, really, in this wilderness. But as well, he's going back up and into the edge of Judah, where Saul is, and Saul is reigning and ruling, where there's danger. And Nabal is a man who has a massive flock of sheep and goats. He's an extremely wealthy man, a man of influence and a man of power. But we see and we read, it seems that he is also a man of allegiance to Saul, is what it would seem as you read the passage. But more than that, he has allegiance to himself. He is filled with pride and he is filled with selfishness. Yet while David is out and in the wilderness, his men, he has 600 men with him, they interact with some of Nabal's employees, his shepherds that are guiding his flocks. We gave the example. If you bring 3,000, 4,000 sheep and goats into an area to eat and to feed and to drink, they destroy the area fairly quickly. It doesn't take them long to eat up the resources that are there. And they didn't, farming wasn't the same back then. They didn't gather bales of hay for that amount of animals. And so they moved them around from location to location. And while they did, these men with their flocks interacted with David, who had previously been a shepherd as he had grown up that way. His father, in fact, owned flocks and he cared for them. And so there's probably some common interest. He probably resonates well with those shepherds and those men that work for Nabal. And while they're there, we find out that David and his men helped protect the flocks and the men that were working for Nabal. It says that they formed a wall around them. They protected them. They didn't take from them. They didn't steal from them. They didn't demand anything from them or demand payment from their flocks. And there comes a point where David and his 600 men are left with a need. It seems that they've run out of resources. They've run out of provisions. And David makes a request to Nabal. He says, if you could just spare us what is at hand. It was during their shearing time, which was a very festive moment in Israel each year during those seasons. They would feast. It was known to be a moment of generosity, those that had these flocks. It was a moment that they built up their wealth. And so he said, in this moment, whatever you have on hand that could help us, would you provide that for us? It's a reasonable request and expectation, knowing what David has done. Now, David didn't, it wasn't a formal agreement. And because of that, Nabal's response to him was irrational. It was selfish. He lashes out. He says, who is David? Who is this son of Jesse? Jesse, the farmer with just a few sheep. Does he not know who I am? And he talks about servants that stray. He sort of insinuates, I see David. David's the one that rebelled against his master Saul, that was serving Saul and was one of Saul's captains of his armies. And he rejects him. He insults David's name, and he will not provide him what David asked. And so here's what I want you to notice tonight, or what we're going to take from it, the main lesson that we want to learn from tonight. What's David's response going to be? And then what's going to happen after that? And notice, you see there, that from this event, here's the primary lesson, the big idea tonight. We're going to learn the importance of offering and applying when we receive it. Whether we are giving good advice and godly advice or receiving godly advice. How do we offer and apply godly wisdom when it comes to us in the form of godly advice? It's a practical application for any of us at any stage or any moment in life. We are always consistently, whether sometimes life feels mundane or monotonous at times, you ever think about this? We're always experiencing something new in this life. There's something new introduced to us in our finite nature and being. As we age, there's certain processes of the aging process that I'm new to this. I've never experienced this. In our relationships, there's moments where something new happens in our marriages or as parenting, and something surprises us, something we didn't expect. In our jobs, whatever it may be, circumstances beyond our control sometimes arise and come out of nowhere, and we're not always exactly sure how to respond. And sometimes the circumstance overwhelms our ability to rightly sort of process what's going on. We're overwhelmed by it. And in those moments, God uses His Word, His Spirit, but also His people to interject into our hearts wisdom. And so let's look at this passage this evening. I want you to notice in verse number 13. So he gets his answer back from Nabal. We won't reread the first part of the chapter. We know that Nabal scorns David, denies his request, and insults him. David's response in verse 13. Notice it says, David said unto his men. So actually, go back to the end of verse 12. They came and told him all those sayings. So nothing else happens. He receives the word from Nabal. And then in verse 13, David speaks. David hears and then speaks. Notice how quickly that is. He says to his men, gird on every man his sword. And they gird on every man his sword. And David also gird on his sword. And it went up after David about 400 men. 200 abode by the stuff. Now what we find, I believe, is that David has a rash response to what Nabal has said. Now you can try to justify what David's doing. Say, well, David's the anointed king. He's God's chosen one. He has the right. He has the authority to do this, right? Isn't he going to be God's king? I think we see from the passage and from David's reaction at the end of the passage that this is a rash response of David. In fact, we know that David had the opportunity to carry out vengeance on Saul. Saul has tried to kill David. Saul tried to murder him. But David does not respond to Saul's evil with evil. He doesn't repay him evil with evil. But it's like, it gets to the middle of chapter 25. It's like David just had enough. It's like all that chasing and all that turmoil that Saul has brought into David's life has weighed it down, and Nabal's words just sort of make him snap. And isn't it interesting sometimes that the event or the person or the circumstance in life that creates for us the most stress, or the most anguish, sometimes that is not the person, the circumstance, the event that draws the deepest part of our ire and our anger. It's the small thing that sets us over the top. It's work, it's the boss, it's whoever it may be that has put the pressure, but it is the wife or the child or the neighbor or the friend that gets the brunt of my anger about that. Someone that I can't lash out to. David says, I'm not going to lash out to Saul, it's God's chosen, but I will lash out at Nabal. No one's going to talk to me like that. And so notice David's rash response. I want you to notice two things about it. And really, it's really kind of systematic as we walk through the passage. We're going to notice a key character trait or a characteristic of each of these things, and then we're going to just seek to apply it to our lives. Think about our own lives tonight. So notice his rash response. I would qualify it with two different words, two different things. It's impulsive, and it is full of vengeance. Impulse and vengeance. Notice David's reaction to Nabal's words was quick. Just, I mean, right away. Go back, if you will. Look at chapter 23. Look at verse number 2. Chapter 23, verse number 2. So the Philistines come down, right? And the Lord tells David to do something. The Philistines come down to fight, and David goes to the Lord. Verse number 2. Therefore David inquired of the Lord, shall I go and smite the Philistines? So David does have a relationship with the Lord in prayer where he speaks to him, should I do this? And then in verse 3, the men question, hey, is this really the right decision? And then notice in verse 4, then David inquired of the Lord yet again. And we've seen that a few times in David's life where there's a decision that has to be made. There's opposition that has come, and David reaches out and says, Lord, what should I do? But you don't find that in chapter 25. It's a quick response. It's impulsive. I think it makes me think of the verse, James chapter 1. You quoted it there, some of it for you. Verse 19 and 20. Read this slowly in your mind. We are to be swift, quick to hear and listen. We are to be slow to speak. We are to be slow to garnish wrath and anger and act out in anger. Notice this. Notice why. We can quote that verse pretty easy. We're quick to speak, quick to hear, slow to speak, slow to wrath. But notice why. For the wrath of man worketh not the righteousness of God. That a quick response of anger, regardless of our excuse, is not a righteous act of God in our lives. That's what the Bible teaches. So let's apply it as we think about our own responses, our own quick words, and our own irrational responses. We can make a lot of excuses. Well, it was an urgent moment. It snuck up on me quick. It built up. It's been building in my mind and my heart, and this was my opportunity to say something. So I just emotionally vomited all over everyone that was near me. You know, but I got it done. They listened to me. They did what I said. So it got the job done, except that we were not like Christ. So did the job get done? Do we excuse it with our passion? I'm just passionate about this. This is just something that needs to be said or done. Or we respond in impulse as David did. But David's impulse was guided by his sinful nature. Notice, vengeance. David's reaction to Nabal was irrational and imbalanced, just like Nabal's reaction to him. David says, could we have whatever you have on hand, a little food, because we've helped guard your flocks. Nabal's reaction is irrational. No, you can't have any of my stuff. Who are you? And then David's response is, who am I? Die. In fact, not all of you, not just you are going to die. Notice, if you go a little further, David explains. David's wandering through the wilderness, and it would seem, or wandering through the mountain, it would see as he come down by the covert of the hill in verse 20. But notice what David has said, within earshot of all of his men, and it seems maybe even Abigail. Surely in vain have I kept all that this fellow hath in the wilderness, so that nothing was missed of all that pertained to him, and he hath required me good for evil. He's evil for good. So and more also do God unto the enemies of David, if I leave of all that pertain to him, his whole household, by the morning, any that pisseth against the wall. That's not a crass phrase here. It's a strong phrase, but it simply means any men in his household. Now, does that sound rational? Ask yourself the question. You say, well, he's God's chosen one. He's going to be the king. This is kind of like treason, right? No. Let's think about the circumstance. Does a man denying food for informal favors ever in God's system of law and justice warrant death? Nowhere. That's nowhere in God's law. So David, the same one that writes Psalm 119 and talks about yearning and hungering, wanting to learn the Lord's statutes and be guided, a lamp unto my feet and a light unto my path, in this moment is guided by the darkness of his heart. Ask the question, does a man's personal insult or a defamation of a family name, even if it is of the coming king, does that ever demand the massacre of an entire household of men? No. David's reaction is an overreaction. It's irrational and it's vengeful. David took the comments personally. He's going to use my dad's name? He's going to talk about my daddy like that? No, he's not going to talk about it like that. But David had clear commands of God. It's not just a New Testament thing that says to love your neighbor and love your enemy and to do good to those that use you or despitefully mistreat you. You have other passages, Leviticus 19:18. You can look there at some point. Deuteronomy 32:34 through verse 43. In God's law, he lays out over and over, I am the one that avenges my name and wrong and sin. I am the Lord. You are not. Don't act out of revenge and spitefulness and vengeance. Let me do those things. Romans chapter 12, verse 16 through 19, you have it quoted there. The last phrase of verse 16 is where it begins. Be not wise in your own conceits, which is what David is doing. He's being wise with his own understanding. Be not wise in your own conceits. Recompense to no man evil for evil. Provide things honest in the sight of all men. If it be possible, as much as lieth in you, live peaceably with all men. Now, living peaceably doesn't just mean you don't punch them. It's also how your heart thinks of them. It's not that I don't curse them with my words, but I also don't curse them with my heart. Dearly beloved, notice the end of the verse, avenge not yourselves, but rather give place unto wrath, for it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, saith the Lord. So ask ourselves the questions tonight to apply. Are my responses rooted in the truth of God? Or are my responses built on a need that I have to be proven right? Or an impulse that I have because I don't want to lay down at night and feel like I've been slighted or belittled or beaten? Which one guides my response? I think it's clear to see tonight from the passage which one was guiding David's response. But notice, if you would, war is now coming, right? War is coming. David says, put on your swords. We're going to battle. And 400 men, I think Nabal had a large household, a group of men that were under him, but 400 warriors that have been out in the wilderness training and fighting the Philistines with David, they're not going to be a match for them. War and massacre and death is on its way. But I want you to notice that one woman's wisdom and discernment stands in the way of disaster. And just as last lesson, when we were in 1 Samuel 25, we said it was an especial warning to men about our foolishness, I think that chapter 25 can also serve as a special heeding of wisdom about the gift that God gives us in wisdom and advice, even from those that are the women in our lives, the moms, the wives. Although this is not David's wife at this point, her wisdom helps him. Notice, if you would, a couple things about her reaction. I would say David's reaction can be qualified this way: impulsive and vengeful. Her reaction is discerning, and she holds a good demeanor about it, and it changes everything. Notice, I want you to think about what Abigail had to process. So they come to Abigail, verse 14. It's probably pretty clear to the whole household who is the wise one here. And this is not to say there's something out of sorts in the home, that she's asserted herself in some way she shouldn't. But it's obvious that she has wisdom, and the household knows it, because they go to her. One of the young men goes to her and says in verse 14, behold, David, he tells her the whole story. David sent messengers out of the wilderness respectfully. He asked for something, and our master railed on David. But they were very good to us, it says in verse 15. Gives the whole testimony, tells it all out. Verse 17, now therefore know and consider what thou wilt do, for evil is determined against our master and against all his household, for he is such a son of Belial, literally a son of worthlessness, that a man cannot speak to him. Notice they go and they speak to her. Notice what she's having to assess here, what she's having to take into consideration before she reacts. She has to think about the wealth and the controversial personality of her husband. She has to think, well, if I go and try to assert myself or go around this, is this going to be an embarrassment to me or to my husband? He's the wealthiest man in this whole region of the country. She has to take into fact, and she says, what am I going to do? Who's right in this situation? One man is extremely wealthy, powerful, and influential. David is not extremely wealthy and powerful and influential at this point, but he does have a place of position. He is a legend in the nation of Israel, and he has all kinds of accolades in battle. So she's stuck between these two personalities. Think also about the social structure of the day, the cultural norms that in a public way, women did not assert themselves this way. For right or for wrong, that's just how the social custom was. And then she also has to think about the number of people that are going to be harmed here and who it is that stands to suffer damage. And there is innocent people at stake. She could have used the opportunity. She could say, well, this is not my place. I'm going to grab a few of the servants and run. She knows her husband's a fool. She says it later in the passage anyway. She says, such is his name, so is he. She recognized it. He's probably a pretty miserable guy to be married to. Even the way that he's acting, his drunkenness at the end of the chapter, drinks himself into a stupor. Literally, the Lord even uses his drunkenness to lead to his own death. He is not the model husband with just a few character flaws. He seems like a dirtbag, right? This is her way out. Like, she could take a servant, she could take whoever. I'm getting out of here. This isn't having anything to do with me. I'm escaping. But she doesn't. Notice that later she says she acts not with either man in mind, but she acts with the Lord in mind. We're going to see that as we walk through the passage. So ask yourself tonight, what is the final deciding factor for most of your decisions in life? Do you tend to make decisions? How do you treat people when you are under pressure? Nabal, when he acts from a place of power, responds in harshness. David, when he reacts in a place of pressure and urgency because his men need food, he responds with violence. She is reacting from a position of her life, her very life, and those around her that she loves being threatened. And yet she uses wisdom. Notice her demeanor. I think this is important too. Verses 18 down through verse 28. Verse 18, it says, Abigail made haste. Notice all the things. She takes 200 loaves of bread, 2 bottles of wine. Now you're picturing, you know, Gatorade-sized bottles. These are large calfskin-type bottles, most likely. 5 sheep that are dressed, 5 measures of corn, 100 clusters of raisins, 200 cakes. Now, it sounds like a feat. Tons of food. Most likely this is a meal, maybe a day or two for them. But she responds in generosity. She says, we have this to give. I'm not going to just hope that my husband gets out. She recognizes what should have happened, and she acts on it herself. And she responds in generosity. But notice her generosity is not dependent on reception. She doesn't take all of this food and put it out in front of David and his men as a negotiating chip and say, David, I know you're hungry. You know, his mouth watering, and the men that are there are like, yeah, just take the deal. She says, if you don't attack my husband and the men in my family, then I will give you all these things. She doesn't do that. Notice the next verse says she actually sends them on ahead. She says, we are going to be generous people. And her generosity was not dependent on how it was received. You ever given something to somebody or tried to do a favor for somebody? You don't feel like they received it the way that they should. I am a horrible gift receiver. Like, receiving gifts makes me nervous. It always has, because I don't feel that my reaction on the outside is ever going to match maybe how I feel on the inside. And you can ask anybody. I would rather open the greatest gifts that anyone's ever given me in my life. I would like to take them to the corner of my house in a small room somewhere and open them when no one is watching and not see anybody for about a week. That is the way that I feel. It's the way that I react, right? But notice, she doesn't demand this great response from him. She's generous because it's who she is. Notice that her humility is not based on status or possession. Think about this. She, as Nabal's wife, is far wealthier than David is. She could have sent for Saul. Saul, everybody knew where Nabal lived. Like, all those soldiers could have come. She could have done something. Her position as a wealthy family in this portion of Israel, she could have used it, but she is humble. Notice it says that she comes and she kneels down before him in verse number 23. She bows herself to the ground. She calls David her Lord. She calls herself his handmaid. She is humble. David was, and there was nothing that made her do that. She is not required to do that. She does. David's coming in a dangerous mood, but she's willing to confront him with truth in a humble way. She doesn't back out, so she's humble, but she's also courageous. She stands in the face even of death. It kind of describes how she came. In verse 20, she came down by the covert of the hill, probably down in a valley where David and his men couldn't see her. And it kind of implies, it feels like she probably has a chance to hear some of what they're talking about, the footsteps of war that are on their way, and she still is willing to stand up and stand out. So she's generous and humble, but she's also courageous. She's humble because she viewed herself and viewed those around her in a God-informed way. We're going to see that as we walk through the passage. She didn't base how she saw others on their power, their wealth, what they had done for her. She saw David as God's chosen, and she saw God as the supreme one over all things. And it changed her demeanor and her interactions. Now, this is where I want us to imply it. Humility in our lives does not come from shame or self-disgust, but it's the natural response of our hearts viewing the Lord as we should. Our demeanor with others in the midst of conflict should never be based on how they've treated us, how they've reacted to us, what their words have been, how violent they've been, how angry they've been, how demonstrative they've been. How I treat others should not be based on them. It should be based on Him. It should be based on the Lord and the image bearer that He has created. And that's exactly what she does in this circumstance. This man has threatened to kill her family, but she responds in a humble way. I want you to think about this. Sometimes the way that we approach conflict is just as important as the words that we say in it. The demeanor of our lives can help till up the hard ground of hearts that need to hear the truth. How you respond and approach someone in your life and in our lives can be just as effective or initially effective as what we say to them or even what we do. And our lives, and I don't mean we should be humble and small. That's not who we see in Abigail. She is courageous. She is strong. She stands up for what she thinks and knows is right. And as the Lord leads her to in this case, she does what she does with poise and with prominence, but she also does it with humility. She doesn't have to do that. She could have stood in pride and selfishness like her husband, or she could have stood in anger and threat like David had, but instead, she chooses the right demeanor. And here, in the last section of the passage is going to kind of inform us as to why she's able to do that. Because she has confidence in the Lord. Notice this last section that we're going to walk through tonight, really verse 25, kind of down through verse 31, 32. I want us to notice the redeeming nature of her advice. And I want us to think about it ourselves, because I can't. Most of us tonight or the next few days are probably not going to have a conflict resolution opportunity that comes up where we say, my family member has said they're going to kill somebody, and I'm going to be the person of neutrality in between. Hopefully, that's not an issue within our congregation. Hopefully. But we are going to have moments of time in our lives where we are either the one that needs to give advice or we are the one that needs to receive advice. So when we look at this last point, first we looked at David, his rash reaction. Then we looked at Abigail and her demeanor and how she responded in a good way. But on this last one, I kind of want us to put ourselves in the position of both. Because sometimes I'm David with a purpose of war because someone has wronged me and I need clarity as to how I should act in the situation. I need advice. And then there's other times where I am, as a Christian, around my brothers and sisters in Christ, or I'm with my family or even my kids and how I steward my grandkids' lives, and as I'm walking through, that I need to be the one to give advice. And so look at it both ways. And I want you to notice the advice that she gives is kind of characterized in three ways: by clarity, by perspective, and by a reminder. Notice the first one, clarity. Abigail presents the circumstance without her own slant or her own pride. She does not try to deceive David. She does not try to change his opinion by emphasizing certain aspects of the event and ignoring others. She lays it out as it is. Notice in verse 25 through 27, if you were to read it, I mean, she says in verse 25, don't regard this man of Belial, even Nabal, for as his name is, so is he. My husband is foolish. She doesn't make any lie for him. She doesn't excuse him. She doesn't say, oh, that's not really what he said. She lays it out with clarity. The truth here is what is going to set her free. And notice, she recognizes the foolishness of her husband. She also recognizes, hey, there's some things about this circumstance I wish had happened differently. Notice at the end of verse number 25, but I, thine handmaid, saw not the young men of my Lord whom thou didst send. Now, notice, she recognized two things. Hey, there's something that you were wronged, and I wish this had happened differently. Sometimes that is a great way to disarm someone in the midst of wrath and anger. It's just to acknowledge, I see where you're coming from, and I wish it hadn't happened that way. That's exactly what she does. But then she also says, notice in verse 27, this is wisdom. She doesn't try to negotiate or excuse or tell David where there's something else that can be done, or hey, there's this other guy, he doesn't have 3,000 sheep but he has 2,000 sheep, if you go to this town maybe he'll give you some food. She says, hey, I want to help. And she gives him, verse 27, now take this blessing which thy handmaid had brought unto my Lord. What does she do? She says, there's a clear, identifiable, physical need, and I want to help with that. You know, sometimes in our conflict issues, our problems, sometimes the conversation, husbands, wives, we know this is true, and sometimes even with our kids, or you sit in a business meeting at work, or you're sitting with somebody that there's a disagreement with, or neighbor, or whatever, and you can talk for hours about how you came to the place that you're in. How did we get here? Whose fault was it? I'm so guilty of this so many times in my life. How did I get here? Whose fault is it? How can I convince you of whose fault it is and how things should have gone better? I can identify how it went and how that shouldn't have happened that way. It should have happened a different way. You talk about it, but notice how quickly she moves from one to the next. My husband is foolish. I wish this hadn't happened this way. I'm sorry you were wrong. I know what's needed in the circumstance, and I'm just going to go ahead and take care of it. She wasn't obligated to do that. She didn't have to do that. It's going to cost them something, not maybe in their wealth, maybe not something huge, but she says, this is something that's within my power to do to ease this problem. And she brings clarity to the situation in doing so. How many of our bad circumstances of life, how much of our anger could be assuaged if someone would just come with advice from time to time and just help us see things clearly? You were wronged. I wish it hadn't happened. I want to try to help fix it. How many times could that help others in our lives? You see a Christian who's fuming over something. You see a Christian who's mad at another Christian, something within a church, something within a family, a neighbor, whatever it may be. How much time? We don't always need victory as much as we need clarity. something happened. I hate that it did. I wish it was different. Here is something to help. Sometimes emotions can cloud our clarity. Sometimes we need to wisely offer clarity to somebody that maybe can't see it in the moment because of their emotions. And a lot of times, my emotions cloud my clarity, and I just need words like water to kind of rinse over the fire for a moment. Help me see what's going on. But you know what's interesting? Sometimes when somebody offers clarity, we ignore it. We don't want the clarity. I want the victory. That's never helpful. It's usually damaging. Am I willing to listen to someone's words and compare them and say, well, you know what? They pointed me to the light of God's word, and I'm listening to God's spirit. He's saying that they're right. Am I willing in my moment of fury to listen? So she offers clarity. Then notice she offers perspective. And this, I think this is probably the strongest aspect of her advice, was that she gives godly perspective. Meaning, and I go back to that word discernment. Discernment can mean the ability to perceive and understand what may be obscure. Obscured by other things or obscured to other people. She sees this clearly. And then she applies the wisdom. Notice what she saw that neither David or Nabal could see. Notice, if you would, in verse 26. Now therefore, my Lord, as the Lord liveth, and as thy soul liveth, seeing this, notice this, seeing the Lord hath withholden from thee, thee from coming to shed blood, and from avenging thyself with thine own hand, now let thine enemies and they that seek after evil to my Lord be as Nabal. She says, hey, she sees the Lord's mercy in the fact that it has not gotten as bad as it could have. And she offers that perspective. Nabal doesn't see that. David doesn't see it. And she goes to David and says, look, right now it's rough, but it's not as bad as it probably could get. And that is God's mercy in working. Neither man could see that. Notice, she also notices God's ability to keep his promises even when people fail. Verse number 28, I pray thee, forgive the trespass of thine handmaid. She's even willing to take the blame. What did she do wrong in the passage? Nothing. But she's willing to take the blame, not in a sinful way or in the shame. She just says, I will take whatever I can from this because I want a good resolution. But notice, for the Lord will certainly make my Lord a sure house. Now, God's promise to give David an eternal kingdom hasn't even happened yet. That's how her perspective and her discernment, that's how good it is here, because she knows this is God's promised king. She understands that. And she says, look, God will keep his promises even when people fail you, David. Even when my husband and you've protected all of his stuff, even when he fails you, God will take care of you. And she sees it, but David can't. Notice she sees God's nature as the ultimate resolution of all conflict and injustice. She says, David, it would probably feel pretty good to just smash and kill and slice Nabal right now. You want to murder. I understand that. But notice, verse 29, yet as a man is risen to pursue thee, to seek thy soul, but the soul of my Lord shall be bound in the bundle of life, in the bundle of life with the Lord thy God, and the souls of thine enemies, them shall he sling out as out of the middle of a sling. She says, God will bring the judgment that needs to be brought, David. So what can she see that David can't? She sees there's an opportunity for mercy. She sees that God keeps his promises even when people fail. She sees that God is the one that will judge. And she also sees, David, you want to stay right before God. It's not worth it to give that up. Verse 31. That this shall be no grief unto thee, nor offense to the heart unto my Lord, either that thou has shed blood causeless, innocently, or that my Lord avenged himself. But when the Lord shall have dealt well with my Lord, then remember thy handmaid. She said, David, if you don't do this, then you live your life without a shadow of a doubt that you are right with the Lord in this decision, that you did not shed innocent blood for no cause. David, it is more worth it to be right with the Lord than it is to be right over man. What wisdom she has. And because he can't see that. But she comes in that moment of his advice. Sometimes perspective can be difficult in a moment of intensity. So we ask ourselves, do we strive to see the big picture of God's work? Am I willing to listen when a Christian comes and says, hey, this really
doesn't matter. Let it go. It's such good wisdom, isn't it? And if we can listen to that, imagine had David not listened to this. And for years, David's a king, but what he sees when he lays down at night is a 15-year-old boy that he killed in the middle of Nabal's barn. And the sheer dread and fear on his face just before his men murdered all of those servants that were out in the field. Just all the screams and the cries of the women and the innocent children that are left behind in a wake of destruction. David would have to live with that the rest of his life. And though he'd be king, he'd have nightmares from it, if not for someone coming along and just saying, "Let this go." And finally, and I love this, I think it's the most beautiful part of the passage. Chapter 25, look at verse 29. Her advice to him is, David, think clearly. David, think rightly. And then she says, David, think back. Did you notice that in verse 29? I mean, she's this eloquent speaker, right? She gives this advice. But her advice is not just great in how eloquent it is. Notice what she does. There can be no accident. There's just no way. Maybe it's just a phrase of the day. I can't find anything that says this is some sort of colloquial phrase in Israel at this time. There is no way this is an accident. The end of verse 29. The souls of thy enemies, notice this, then shall he sling out as out of the middle of a sling. What is she saying to David? David, in the same way that God protected your life against Goliath, he can take care of my husband in any other challenge. What does she do? She reminds him, David, you can trust God. And she just uses this nuanced phrase. She doesn't lecture him. She doesn't talk too long like I do. She doesn't do that. She just says, David, all your enemies are going to be like that stone that just got shot out of that sling when you were with the giant. She reminds him, remember how good God has been to you? Remember how great God is over the circumstances of your life? Remember how God has protected you? David, just think back. If you could trust God then, I promise, David, you can trust him right now. Now, sometimes we want to give advice based on the best book or the best self-help or whatever it may be. We want to give advice on here's what you're supposed to do. Sometimes the best advice that we need in our lives is somebody bring us along and say, think clearly. Think rightly, the way God wants you to think. And think back. You can trust the Lord. So let me ask you, Christian, tonight, who can speak into your life in the way that Abigail did into David's? Now, they don't really know each other too much, maybe at all, but God gives us this gift, this opportunity of other Christians. It's vital as Christians to have deep, lasting, meaningful relationships with other believers. Are you surrounded by people? Let me just ask, is there someone that by God's grace and mercy you have friended in such a deep way that you have allowed yourself to be refined by them, that as a cord bound together, as iron sharpening iron, you've allowed God to use someone in your life, you've opened yourself up to them, you have built relationship with them to the place that they can come and put their hand around you and say, remember, you can trust God? Who could speak to you the way that Abigail spoke to David? And let me just give you a recommendation. Yes, our husbands or our wives, our family, those within our household can do it, but sometimes trouble wraps up our whole household. And I think that each Christian, if you're especially, we have the gift of a local church, there should be someone in your life that you are growing in relationship with God together. And if there is not, I say this humbly and respectfully, there is a problem. If you do not have someone in your life, it doesn't mean it's all your fault, it's all somebody else's fault, but it doesn't, because God, in His Word, prioritizes His people. Who can speak to you in this way? David received Abigail's advice with gratitude and humility, so God worked. How do we receive advice this evening? Who do we need to give advice to? Not to build the fires of the drama of their life, but to give clarity so God can work. To remind them, you can trust the Lord. Let's ask God to help us this evening. Father, help us tonight. You've given us your people. May we be bold like Abigail at times when we need to stand in the gap and help bring clarity and discernment and perspective and a reminder of your goodness and grace. Lord, we know as we read the rest of the passage, we know that David received it with gratitude. He was joyful that you had sent someone. And he listened. He said, I hearken, I heed your advice. Lord, may we respond when you orchestrate the moments of our life to bring someone along with good advice that helps our lives. May we listen. May we change. Lord, help us, teach us. Your word can soothe our hearts. Our lives can be lived in joy and harmony and unity with others when our perspective is right. So give us that mercy, grant us that grace in Jesus' name.